rent increase if they are in income restricted housing unless their income exceeds the threshold.
So I will be entirely honest and say that I'm probably not the best person to ask. What I can share with you is that we have had several members within Community Alliance of Tenants who have received rent increases in regulated affordable housing that has caused a displacing event that forced them to relocate into private market housing. Okay. So we have seen it on the ground, and it is very distressing. Some folks, I believe one person that I can think of off the top of my head, did end up homeless.
Yeah. And one of the scenarios that we're trying to avoid is in a circumstance where there is an actual income restriction, and that's not always the case. Mm-hmm. When the household income exceeds that restricted level, they either have to move out or the nonprofit affordable housing property manager loses the tax exemption on that property. Mm-hmm. So that's a scenario where I think an exemption makes sense because it would be a burden to that housing provider.
There are definitely some nuanced situations in which I think exemptions are appropriate, but there are some others that a flat exemption does not include, in which relocation would be extremely necessary.
Okay.
And so that's why we're recommending that the Rental Services Commission take this up with affordable housing providers to talk through those and include it in the language.
Great. Thank you.
But to be clear, to take the language out for now so that they are covered. Folks in those properties are covered.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler and Commissioners. My name is Christina Dirks. I am a staff attorney with Legal Aid Services of Oregon. Thank you for inviting me to come speak with you today. I was a member of the Relocation Technical Advisory Committee. I'm currently a member of the Rental Services Commission.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. As an attorney at Legal Aid, I solely represent low-income tenants. That's my practice area. I've seen from working with clients directly the devastating impact that the housing crisis has had on the most vulnerable members of our community. Experts tell us that there is significant proven financial, emotional, social, and educational harm suffered by tenants as a result of involuntary displacement. We saw on the ground that the passage of the temporary relocation ordinance provided tenants with a critical reprieve by stabilizing the rental market. As a result of the ordinance, we know that tenants saw fewer exorbitant rent increases, less wholesale displacement of buildings for renovation and subsequent changes in the demographics like we saw at the Normandy. And if I could just briefly give a shout out to the tenants of the Normandy, who are amazing, and they're here today in the balcony. And we saw fewer no-cause notices. And I know from my casework and from those of my colleagues at Legal Aid that no-cause notices are usually a mask for retaliation or often a mask for retaliation or discrimination. The passage of a permanent relocation ordinance is an important step towards recalibrating the power imbalances between tenants and landlords right now in our market. I commend the mayor and the commissioners for lifting the single unit exemption. We know that the single unit exemption disproportionately impacts some of those vulnerable renters, including larger families, as well as individuals with screening barriers that make it hard to get into housing. This is an important equity issue. I also support the reporting requirements of landlords to submit a form to PHB if they're going to claim an exemption status. Not only does this give us the ability to gather important data, but it hopefully will put some check on potential abuses from landlords misusing the exemptions. Finally, I want to support the requirement of landlords notifying tenants of their rights to relocation when issuing a triggering notice. Many tenants still do not understand their rights under the relocation ordinance, and this notification is an important step to helping to educate those of these critical tenant protections. However, there are some gaps in coverage in the current ordinance, and I think the ordinance could be improved. I believe the following suggestions will make the ordinance better for tenants and also further the policy intentions behind the ordinance. The first is in the notification requirements I just mentioned in subsection D. The proposed language fails to require landlords to notify tenants of their right to relocation prior to the renewal of a rental agreement. And as you all know, one of the triggering events is if a landlord fails to renew a rental agreement on substantially the same terms. Given the failure to renew, given that that is a triggering event, there seems to be no apparent reason why we want to leave that out of notification requirements. Tenants who are faced with a rent agreement renewal are often the least likely to be aware that they may be entitled to relocation. As you may have seen, most of the press and the educational materials around the ordinance focus on no-cause notices and the 10% rent increase. So lots of tenants don't know that this covers them as well. In addition, we have seen creative ways that landlords have started lease renewal options since the passage of the ordinance. What we have seen is that landlords will often creatively present lease renewal options as a tenant choice, leading a tenant to believe that they are electing one of these choices, and it's not a landlord actually issuing a notice that would trigger relocation. And we have talked to many, many tenants who were unaware that they were entitled to relocation based on these options that they were given. And so for this reason, because of this misleading communication, I think it's especially important that we include those tenants in being advised of their rights to relocation. My second suggestion is in subsection C, where it exempts associated housing costs from the analysis of whether a new rental agreement is substantially the same as the old one and would trigger relocation. We have seen that the exclusion of associated housing costs is not only harmful to tenants, but has created a loophole for landlords that they are actively using. Since the passage of the ordinance, I have seen landlords issue excessive increases to associated housing costs, such as parking or pet rent, in order to avoid having to pay a 10% rent increase. The end result is that landlords are getting more than a 10% rent increase, just in a different form, and even more importantly, the tenants are paying more than a 10% rent increase in a different form. But the economic burden to tenants is exactly the same, and unfortunately, these tenants are not entitled to relocation under the current version of the proposed ordinance. And I'd like to point out that at the RELO, Relocation Technical Advisory Committee, we specifically discussed and agreed on this issue. We all felt strongly, or I know the tenant advocates just felt strongly, the landlords agreed, they may have not felt strongly, that it did not seem appropriate to allow a landlord to get around relocation by raising costs that are under their control, that are associated housing costs, in a way to avoid having to pay relocation and issue a rent increase notice.
I thought that was the purpose of this amendment. No. It doesn't do it, in your opinion?
No. It doesn't. So my understanding of the purpose of the amendment, and I'm sorry if this is a bit too, if I divert too much, but there was confusion under the prior language in that it didn't address situations where a lease renews automatically on its own terms versus a landlord just saying, yes, I'll renew your rental agreement, but there's different terms. So in the first situation, the landlord automatically has to pay relocation and the tenant doesn't have to elect for it. In that second situation, the tenant would have to elect to say, no, I'm not renewing, I want relocation. So I believe the intent of the ordinance now is to kind of separate them to make those two situations clear when each one would occur and the timelines and what a tenant needs to do to elect for relocation.
So basically we just haven't got the language quite right yet.
Yeah. So it would be my suggestion that we just strike the language or associated housing costs from subsection C, and that would address this loophole that's been created.
But then it wouldn't, because then landlords were, as you say, adding on utilities or pet
right.
costs.
So I think if we strike the associated housing cost language, it would just be any rental agreement that's offered on substantially different lease with substantially different terms would give the tenant the right to say, I don't want to renew and I want my relocation benefits.
So, colleagues, I'll tell you why this is in, and this won't be popular, but I'm going to give you my best shot at it. I tried to focus, as my team and I in the Housing Bureau are writing this, on what costs can a landlord singularly control, plus what is legal. And our attorneys upstairs, and I got to trust them because I'm not an attorney, advised us that we could not include utilities as part of that 10%. That's just the law. So that is what that is. Other things, parking fees, for example, storage fees, there is a choice there that the tenant can make. I realize it's not a good choice, and I realize it's not a happy choice, but it's not solely a choice made by the landlord. And there we chose not to include that, because once you include it, then you're in the game of what else gets included, and we just didn't feel that was necessary for this ordinance.
So, Mayor?
Yes.
Their choices, get rid of your pet, get rid of your car, get rid of your stuff, and don't pay the increased cost? Is that what you're saying?
The focus was making sure that people and their families had a roof over their head in a housing emergency, and we thought it was secondary, not unimportant, but secondary as to whether they have to park their car on the street, which is free in most neighborhoods in this community, or in immediate proximity to the rental unit. Again, tough trade-off, but that's what we made.
Mayor?
It's helpful to understand.
Commissioner Fish.
I just want to acknowledge that what complicates the question of utilities is that for many of the multifamily buildings we're talking about, there are no individual meters. So there's a significant challenge in figuring out how is that figure calculated to begin with. Is it the total amount of water that the landlord claims is consumed in the building and all of the outflow divided by the number of units based on square footage or just in the aggregate? Pardon me?
Or occupancy.
Does it include, for example, the water used in a separate part of the building that has washer dryers that people pay for? Is that cost being included? So while I think there may be some legal prohibition on us, strictly speaking, in terms of what is the percent increase in utilities in a perfect world if you could calculate per person, I don't think most multifamily buildings divide up the utility rates in any consistent way. And so I'm a little concerned that we may be putting form over substance here. And we ought to take a deeper dive here to make sure that people are not larding up utility. And it may be illegal, but it doesn't prevent people from doing it, mm-hmm. charging excessive utility rates for the purpose of getting around the 10% cap.
Fair statement, and I'll get to Commissioner Fritz in a moment. But I want to respond to that. This falls under the category of letting the perfect be the enemy of the good, because then it gets into this question, and it opens up a question on a whole separate issue that we had in this council chamber 2 weeks ago around how do we account for individual metered units. And I think we acknowledged on this council that that's a subject that the council has not been able to solve over a period of years. So rather than injecting that complex policy question into this ordinance, we decided, number one, we'll uphold state law, which says we can't include the utility rates anyway under the 10%. And if we want to take this up, I'm all for it, but let's do it in the conversation we're having around the utility question. And we've empaneled smart people like these on the RSC to potentially be able to take these up. But I don't think it is wise to try to close a policy question that's been out there for many, many years unresolved in the context of an ordinance that we're trying to get through in the midst of a housing emergency.
And Mayor, we have lots of testimony to get to. We're going to be breaking sometime around midnight for breakfast and then come back.
Pancakes, I hope.
But the question the council debated recently was how do you allocate a discount program when you can't measure usage? That's an entirely different question as to how do landlords allocate water, and if there is, let's say, for example, if the council were to say there's a 3% increase in utility rates this year, but a renter gets a bill showing a 10% increase, that ought to be a red flag that something is happening that's out of the ordinary. And if it is designed to circumvent the cap, whether we close that now or later, that's something of our concern.
I will add this to the list for the Housing Bureau, and this may actually be a legal council question. I do not believe, or at least it's been represented to me, that landlords in Oregon already cannot legally charge more for utilities than what their utility bill actually is.
But technically
that is the case, but depending on the circumstance, we have people who are circumventing that law. Another trend that we have seen is where we have a flat rate that is charged per occupancy for water, sewer, and garbage on top of actual usage. So you have people who lived in a unit for a certain number of years and water, sewer, and garbage was included, or it was separate, but they never had a per person occupancy fee, and all of a sudden they were added a per person occupancy fee, or it went up or something of that nature, yep. Which is it's sticky, but it does happen.
But you're right, Mayor. I mean, the utility provisions are clearly regulated by Chapter 90 of the Landlord-Tenant Act.
Yes.
I think a way that this could be addressed is you could really speak to associated housing costs under the control of the landlord, right, that are set by the landlord, because utilities are not set by the landlord. They may be padding it in ways that are unlawful under the Landlord-Tenant Act, but there is, you know, lots of housing costs that are set by the landlord and just fully, you know, benefiting the landlord, and they're probably covering some costs, but they're setting that amount. Because I think the end result is you have, you know, you can raise the associated housing costs so far that you force someone to move out without mm-hmm. relocation. A new person moves in and you raise the rent however much you want, and you're starting from ground zero, right? So you raise the rent 200% or whatever the market will bear. Not this 200%, but maybe it is. And so it perpetuates the problem. It is a big loophole that we are seeing actively being taken advantage of.
Fair enough. So, colleagues, would you like to hear from the Housing Bureau or go to public testimony?
Oh, I'm not sorry. I'm not done.
I'm sorry. I have one more.
I apologize.
It's okay.
I'm sorry. Commissioner Fritz had a question.
Yes.
Well, I was wanting to make Ms. Holland made the point that I was making. We had heard that where previously there was no utility payment, suddenly a new you are being charged $200 for utility, which was previously included in the rent, and that was what I thought this was address. So I want to get all the points on the table. I appreciate the clarification that the mayor did. Wondering how just deleting or associated housing costs solves the problem, because if you previously didn't get utilities on your bill and then you suddenly get $200, that's...
Sure. So I kind of see those as two issues. I see the unbundling of services as one issue, and the raising of associated housing costs is another issue. I have argued and successfully argued that under the current version of the ordinance, the unbundling is already covered as a substantial lease term.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Thank you.
However, I think associated housing costs that are already existing in the contract, but then with the new contract, they're raised significantly. Those would not be covered under this ordinance.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Maybe there's another way to slice this, which is if we choose not to close this potential loophole where there's the, you know, opportunity for padding, maybe what we ought to do in year one is make sure that tenants get accurate reporting of what the actual annual increases are of these rates. So we just came through a year in which there was no increase in garbage.
Mm-hmm.
And there was about a 4% increase in combined water sewer. I will tell you, the Water Bureau gets contacted by tenants saying, I can't believe how much my water and sewer rates are going up, and they have no relationship to the rates that the council adopted.
Right.
So something is going on. I think it may be that in year one we deal with it as a notice question. You know, take a look at your bill. If this goes up, call Community Alliance of Tenants, get the information. Maybe later we look at it as a closing of the loophole issue.
Mm-hmm. So my third and final point is regarding the exemptions. And while I do not support the expanded list of exemptions, I want to focus my suggestion on the need to notify tenants of a landlord's exempt status. For some of the new exemptions that were added, the tenants may not know that they are not entitled to relocation and the landlord is exempt. In order to give these tenants clarity, I would suggest that the ordinance require landlords to provide tenants with a copy of the exemption reporting form that they submit to PHB at the same time that the landlord would otherwise be required to provide the notification to the tenants of their rights to relocation under subsection D. That's all I have. Thank you for your time, and thank you for your commitment to
Excellent.
Tenant protections.
Thank you. Thanks, all three of you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay, so with that, we move to public testimony. Unless, colleagues, did you want to hear from the Housing Bureau on any of these issues right up front?
I guess I am.
Why don't you come on up?
I guess I'm inclined to want to delete the exemption that relates to dwelling unit regulated as affordable housing by a federal, state, or local government for a period of at least 60 years.
Could we hear from the Housing Bureau on that? Because this is a fairly complex issue, and before we start putting amendments on the table, I think we should hear what the logic was.
Okay. So Commissioner Shannon Callahan, Housing Bureau, so the regulated affordable housing is actually regulated on an attendance income level, and it's allowed to go up based on the MFIs and a number of different things in a regulatory agreement. We don't think that it's a significant factor and that this amendment is actually necessary. However, our affordable housing partners are extremely concerned about the removal of this amendment and, quite frankly, have some concerns about the length and duration of the 60 years. We don't necessarily regulate all of the affordable housing in the city of Portland. Much of it was created before the 60-year requirement happened. I'm particularly thinking of some properties with HUD contracts, et cetera, that may be owned by a partner like Home Forward. It's clearly a policy choice by this council, but it is something that our folks in the community who are providing affordable housing in partnership with the city are extremely concerned that this is, I believe the removal would be problematic for them, and that's what I can.
Don't these entities issue no-cause evictions?
Under the previous housing commissioner, you required that all new regulatory agreements going forward, we prohibited no-cause evictions, and that policy has been in place for a few years. They would be subject to. There's also another. They are also usually subject to the Uniform Relocation Act. So I see what you're saying, though, Commissioner.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, first of all, I asked a question about this when Matt was presenting because it's very cryptically written. I mean, it sounds like something straight out of a tax code or something. So I'm trying to figure out what exactly are we talking about. I mean, I thought it was home forward, but it sounds like
home forward would definitely be included, but it would be any regulated affordable housing as long as it was affordable for a period of 60 years or longer. But that would include many of Home Forward's units as well as many other affordable housing providers in the community.
Like nonprofit providers? Is that who we're...
Correct.
Okay. That sounds like a big number. I mean, it could be a big number of units to me. And do we have any quantification?
So can I throw a scenario out there just so we could possibly understand when this becomes an issue? A family is an affordable unit. That rent is based on their income. Their income goes up significantly enough that while they wouldn't be forced to move out, their rent could go up more than 10%, and we don't want that to trigger RELO. Is that a scenario we're trying to avoid?
So there are a lot of different scenarios. I think under this one, there are renters who live in regulated housing, and part of the lease agreement or the contract that they're in is that they pay 30% of their income toward rent. So, yes, you could have a scenario where somebody is earning very little money. Maybe they're working part-time and they're in regulated affordable housing, or maybe they're not working at all. And then so the subsidy that is helping them stay in the rental unit is covering most of the housing cost. And then when they see a significant increase in their income, their lease agreement should. And again, I don't know what all of the lease agreements say between the providers of affordable housing. We don't have a full compilation of all the terms of the lease agreement. But in that scenario, they would have to pay 30% of their annual income toward rent. And that could be a significant increase, but that is the policy framework under which a lot of affordable housing with subsidy built in is regulated.
And then there's the other scenario that I already mentioned, which is that the income goes up so much that they no longer qualify for the subsidy, and that housing provider would either have to pay RELO or they would lose their tax-exempt status. Those are two scenarios that I think are reasonable for us to want to avoid.
I mean, that is another scenario where we need to... I mean, the virtue of regulated units is that once individuals are making enough money that we can move a new family in. You know, we have a deficit of 23,000 affordable housing units in the city. And so part of this was that sense of, well, as people can earn income and move into the private market, we need... This is what we heard from some of the affordable housing providers.
Right. So could we be more specific with the language that says if the increase is driven by the tenant's income, then that is not a RELO trigger? Because we're hearing from CAT and from Legal Aid that they're considered about they're concerned with other scenarios that aren't triggered by the tenant's income, where that tenant should be entitled to RELO.
Can I just make a comment? Having served on the Home Forward Board and then as Housing Commissioner, as I listen to this very thoughtful discussion, I'm beginning to think of 100 examples where there's a federal regulatory agreement, a state regulatory agreement. We have a regulatory agreement. We have a policy, informal policy, that when we acquire preservation properties and people no longer qualify, we grandfather them in because we don't want to get in the business of acquiring properties and then evicting people. So I can think of many different examples. Here's the question I want to ask. Is this exemption, either under Dan's view, which is eliminated, or the current proposal, which is included, is it an urgent issue that needs to be resolved tonight without the benefit of a lot of information? Or can we choose either to keep it in or keep it out and come back with some feedback from our affordable housing partners to better understand the issue? Because I have a feeling...
Yeah, and that was my proposed amendment. It wasn't to delete it outright and forget about it, but just delete it for now, have the Rental Services Commission and whoever the other affected parties are to come back to us on it.
Thank you.
At a later date.
I'm not done with my... Old one,
but
here, I'll get that to you.
Okay.
What's the harm? So I guess what we're asking is, what's the harm in that? We are talking about partners that have substantial due process protections already in place for their tenants based on regulatory agreements, state and federal law, and the like. So what's the harm in taking it out altogether and just putting a 2-month clock on bringing back something that we can all understand that's tailored to the situation that our nonprofit and federal partners have raised?
That is an option that is available to you. I will, again, reiterate just from the affordable housing partners I talked to, they are very concerned about this provision, and so I will let you know that at the outset. And I, without the benefit of having the partners here who are dealing with these very complex regulatory agreements, I would be loath to say what the proper response is, but it is indeed your policy cause, City Council.
Well, the flip side is we could keep it in and send it to RSC. And have them look at it. I mean, Right. Either way, we're going to have issues.
I would imagine that we need to look at this and clarify. I mean, I think also what Katrina was noting about the incidents where this is coming up. I mean, I would like to have more information about what she's particularly concerned about, and especially what the tenants are experiencing. Oh. I think, as you said, Commissioner, there are many different varieties of regulated housing.
It's a hornet's nest.
And our intent was the 60-year policy was not to cover those shorter-term durations, things that are the 10-year tax exemptions that the city gives or otherwise. The intent was for long-term committed affordable housing providers. And so even this was a compromise that our providers are not particularly pleased with.
And by the way, no disrespect to our oversight body that's advising us. This is a highly specialized area based on regulatory agreements with federal and state. Whatever the council decides to do, I would feel more comfortable if we knew within 30 days we get a written submission from our nonprofit partner saying, here's the problem, here's the real world examples, write it so even I can understand it. Mm-hmm. And then the council can decide either that's so clear and we'll act legislatively or we'll seek outside advice. But right now I think the target is a moving target and it's almost impossible to understand what's the problem we're trying to solve.
So Commissioner Fritz, I will commit to that and I will bring it to the RSC immediately.
Commissioner Fritz or Fish?
I was responding to Commissioner Fish. Sorry. Did I say Fritz? Who did I say?
Well,
That guy over there. Sorry.
I consider it an honor, but I mean, it's...
Good-looking guy on the end. I will commit to bringing that to RSC ASAP, and we will. You have the leadership of the Housing Bureau right here hearing that directive.
Well, I guess I still... My preference is to omit it, to do it the other way around. Omit it. And then have those groups come back to us, and then we'll add it back in. Because, all I see here really is, quite frankly, it's a double standard being created.
There's a motion on the table. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
We have a motion from Commissioner Saltzman and a second from Commissioner Udaly.
Can I give a rationale for my
Certainly, name? Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a double standard, in my opinion, because we are saying to, on the one hand, these are nonprofit housing providers that we value and cherish as partners, as we have for a long time. Mm-hmm. But let's face it, there's also there's a lot of landlords that have been out there providing affordable housing for a long time, too. And we're sort of saying we're going to not be so concerned about what the policies and practices of the nonprofits as we are with the for-profits. So I think it's fair to strike it and educate us all about it because we obviously need more education about the issue here. And then we'll probably cave and put it back in, is my prediction.
Well, and I would just like to say...
So I want to be clear. I'm not going to cave. I don't think we should... I trust the folks sitting in front of us that are the Housing Bureau who have actually had the conversations with the providers. And, we have informed this ordinance based on that feedback. As I said right up front, that doesn't mean we're going to catch every single eventuality. This is imperfect. This is not a just cause eviction framework. This is a RELO framework that we are putting in as a stopgap measure because we don't have action at the state level. So again, I caution us, let's not let perfect be the enemy of the good. And for every one of these things, these are complex trade-offs, and anything we do here can have unforeseen consequences.
Mayor,
so I just caution us to be making substantive policy changes on the fly. These guys did a good job of doing their homework and bringing us an ordinance with as much input and education and information as possible. Commissioner Fish.
I do think Dan makes a valid point in this regard. We have spent a lot of time crafting these exceptions such that I think we can take them and generally explain the problem we're trying to solve, and we've had a lot of feedback. For the life of me, I still don't understand the problem we're trying to solve here, and there may be a problem we're trying to solve. There may be a good faith thing, and Dan calls it caving. I call it legislating. And if they come back with a compelling argument as to why there should be something tailored, let's put it in. But in fairness, we have a lot more information about the other exceptions, and we've thought them through. I sitting here can't justify this exception because other than we've been told there's a problem, but I don't legislate that way.
May I make a suggestion?
Commissioner Fritz.
It's 2 hours and 10 minutes after this hearing was supposed to start, and people have been waiting to testify all that time. The amendment is on the table. We'll vote on it after the testimony so that people can give some input on it.
Could I just quickly go through two more while we have the Housing Bureau here, and it's
yes,
fresh in my mind?
May I just say one thing on the exemption?
Certainly,
I think that I will be frank with you. Our legal interpretation and the view of some of our nonprofit providers are at odds on this. And really what our view is that the triggering event when the income level rises and the way that the lease is structured should not trigger relocation. They have a difference in legal opinion on that, and that's why we put this in here. Our lawyers and we believe one thing, but they think differently. And because of all of the different regulatory agreements that they have had over a period of time with state and federal authorities, that is their concern. And so without going deeply into it, that is truly what the crux of why this is in here, and it is a compromise. So with that, I'll leave you to the
Thank
rest
you.
Of your questions.
So Commissioner Fritz had put a question on the table. I believe it was described potentially as a Scribner's error. Would you like her to restate it, or do you recall that? And
it's
have
on
a
the
response?
Exemption number 10, where dwelling unit rendered uninhabitable not due to the action or inaction of a landlord or tenant. Under what circumstances would a rendered uninhabitable due to the action of a tenant, why would that be then triggering relocation?
So what we're trying to get at with this exemption is actually those type of incidents that the mayor indicated earlier, which are either natural or man-made disasters. So we're trying to take out any of the equation from any action or inaction of any of the actual players. And so what we're trying to get to here, which we'll define more closely in administrative rule, are those situations where, you know, there's an earthquake or a flood, but also, as the mayor indicated, you know, there could be a gas main explosion that is literally, you know, which is why we talked about a stricter definition of natural disaster, and have chosen to go with this language. This is the advice of and the telling of our attorneys and trying to craft to get to that point. I think
okay,
we will.
I understand.
We'll clarify it.
It was confusing language, but it does make sense that something can go wrong with a property. It's not landlord negligence or action. It's not tenant negligence or action. It's beyond everyone's control.
So I understand what is the intent is. I'm not sure I'm convinced this is the right language, but that's
okay.
Fine.
One other piece to add. The reason that both parties in the lease agreement were included in the language of the exemption is the Bureau didn't want a scenario where we were being flooded with landlords claiming that their unit had been rendered uninhabitable due to the action of a tenant, and then we would need to rule on that because tenant.
Okay, I understand.
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Thank you.
Lots of questions raised, various aspects of notifications, and this is my last before I let you go to the seat. Katrina had raised the question of, I believe it was Katrina had raised the question of notifications. I had made the statement that there are actually several opportunities in our communications to provide information. A subsequent request was made around notifications notifying tenants, and I would add to that landlords, of their rights and responsibilities, including notification to tenants that they are moving into a unit or considering moving into a unit that is exempted. Is that something we can do through administrative rule?
Yes, that is something that we can do to a degree in an administrative rule.
Great. Colleagues, is there anything else before I move this to public testimony?
Can I just ask one thing?
Hi.
Yes, legal counsel. Hello. Welcome.
Thank you. I just want to clarify for the record and for the council clerk's benefit that there are two amendments on the table. The first amendment is Commissioner Fritz's amendment, which is to add the language in number 12, and the second amendment is Commissioner Saltzman's amendment, which is to strike the language in G8.
Correct.
Is that the extent of Commissioner Saltzman's amendment? There was an other language elsewhere.
Well, it was to strike it and then to ask the input of the Rental Services Commission come back to us with a recommendation.
So that might be potentially a directive in the ordinance.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. How many people do we have Mayor? Signed up? Yes, Commissioner Fish.
Four.
So can we have a quick colloquy as you suggested?
Why don't we take a 3-minute break, please?
No, we can do it on the record.
Oh, sorry. We're on recess. Welcome back, everybody.
We're
I hope
back.
You had a nice
feeling
break.
Refreshed. Feeling refreshed. So, Mayor, as you know, I have signaled my support for the compromise package that you and Commissioner Udaly have worked out. And now it seems like we have two amendments that have to be resolved tonight. In a few minutes, I have to leave because I'm representing the city on the Sanctuary City panel of Multnomah County Reads at the library. So I'm representing the city in that discussion. What I would like to say, my understanding is we'll be voting on this next week and likely have an emergency clause that's added to this for the reasons that we've discussed. My request is that if this hearing goes later and it appears there's one or more amendments that need to be voted on, but there's not consensus on the council, I would ask that you consider kicking the amendments to next week so the council can vote on the amendments, then slap an emergency clause and adopt the matter. I think that would be an alternative. That is within our rights to do if we're still intending to put an emergency clause. I guess what I'm saying is if my vote matters on one of these amendments, I would ask that you set it over for next week so that I can have the benefit of reviewing the testimony and voting. And then I think it's our intent to slap an emergency clause and adopt the whole thing.
Very good. And in the event that we have these two amendments and none others, and I'm not saying that's how it'll end, but in that event, Commissioner Fish, would you like to go on the record prior to departure on these two amendments in the event that we do vote on them today?
Well, no, because I think it would be disrespectful because I'm not going to have the benefit of the testimony. I could technically figure out some way to get on the phone and vote. I think you'll know whether there's a consensus around these amendments, Mayor. If there isn't a consensus, I would just ask that you consider kicking them to next week so I have an opportunity to cast a vote.
And I hear you, and I want to underscore what you said because it's true. We are deploying you as the City Council tonight to
represent
our interests.
Well, and also, to the credit of you and Commissioner Udaly, this has been a very collaborative process. I want to make sure that we continue to do this in a collaborative way.
Great. Thank you.
So thank you.
Public testimony time, the time you've all been waiting for. 2 minutes, name for the record, don't need your address, 30 seconds before the yellow light. When your time is up, you'll hear a buzzer and see a red light. Please stop when your time is up because I don't like playing microphone cop. First three, please.
Okay, we have a total of 54.
Very good.
And the record sign-up sheets are closed now, correct?
Okay, sign-up sheets are closed, that's correct.
The first three are Ron Garcia, Mary Mann, and Brian Park, and they'll be followed by Lois Molina, Hill Nam, and Ali Sayer.
All right. Good evening, Mayor Wheeler, Commission. Thank you for having us. My name is Ron Garcia. I am the president of the Rental Housing Alliance of Oregon. I was also had the privilege of being appointed to the Mayor's Residential Services Commission, where I recently resigned because of my opposition to the council's taking up the elimination of the single unit exemption here tonight. So without any discussion from my part on the merits of the relocation package itself. I really do want to focus on the single unit exemption and perhaps ask you, even with the various other exemptions you're putting in it, to reconsider that. In my opinion, this proposal is not a win-win solution to a housing crisis that we face. It's not a win-lose issue for either tenants' rights, affordable housing advocates, or landlords. In my opinion, this proposal is a lose-lose issue that negatively affects all small landlords and tenants in Portland combined. By imposing the same dollar amount of monetary penalties on individual owners as has already been levied on larger investors in order to legally terminate a rental contract or raise a rent, the results are simple and, in my opinion, predictable. If I'm one of the 25,000 individual owners who have recently seen the value of my condo or home appreciate in Portland due to the lack of supply and the high demand for housing, and to now be burdened by the city with what amounts to me as a huge and punishing financial hardship for me individually by being required to pay thousands of dollars in cash for my tenant's relocation, I'm going to be compelled to absorb those expenses as another closing cost when I sell my house to a buyer who will not be an investor but will be an owner-occupied, therefore taking one more rental unit out of the market and placing one more tenant in an already tight rental market trying to find another place to live that doesn't exist. And I believe that the 25,000 unit, it's callous.
Done.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And I personally am sorry that you did resign from the commission. I'd love to have your input and thoughts going forward, but I understand you made a clear statement. I understand it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Hello. My name is Mary Mann. I'm part of the Rental Housing Alliance. I co-own a duplex for 20 years in the city of Portland. However, I was 39 years old and renting before I bought my first home as a divorced single mom of a high school senior. The answer to the housing issue is not going to be solved by putting the burden on the very people that are taking all the risk to invest in rental property. The city is responsible with its 2016 rules, with causing huge numbers of owners to raise their rents by 9.9%, myself included. I was under market and have been. Shame on you. I never would have raised my rents this way, but I did it out of fearful self-defense and good business practice. My business partner, against my advice, wanted to move some of his family into one side of the duplex. He paid the $4,200 relocation fee. That money is given before the tenants move out and before a final walkthrough is performed. Because of the failure of the tenants to disclose some conditions, we have over $2,000 in damages and costs that we cannot recover. The mail to notify this man and other tenant have been undeliverable. Since relocation money was paid in advance, they did not need the deposits to move into another apartment. So we are a victim because of this rule. If this passes for single units, I see the same thing happening to other owners. With the city's 2016 rules, landlords are tightening up their rental requirements so more marginal applicants will not be accepted, to reduce the potential of having to give no-cause or for-cause evictions. The very tenant population the city says it wants to protect is being victimized by the city's very own rules. Please do not pass any more regulations on to rental property owners. We are not the bad guys here. Onerous and financially burdensome rules that micromanage rental relationships between renters and tenants under free market terms are destructive, non-productive to solving our housing needs, and very alienating to the business owners who provide the existing housing.
Thank you for your testimony. Good afternoon.
Hello. My name is Brian Park, and I'm a primary care physician at a safety net clinic in Southeast Portland. I am here today with the Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good, or MACG, to urge your support for the mandatory relocation assistance that ensures all renters are permanently protected from forced displacement. They tell us in medical school that patients are our best teachers, and there have been no better teacher to the plague of our housing crisis than a patient I'll call Stan. I met Stan my first year of residency, where his medical diagnoses read like a laundry list of chronic conditions: diabetes, congestive heart failure, high blood pressure, COPD, chronic pain. These conditions led to many visits to the hospital, which broke Stan's heart, because if there's one thing he loved in life, it was his work as a carpenter. At our first visit, he shared a photo with me on his phone of a half-finished walnut wood dining table he was making. It was gorgeous. It was the promise of finishing that table that got Stan to agree to regular visits with our nutritionist, physical therapist, and myself. Stan thrived initially. He lost 30 pounds, his back pain became tolerable, and he started taking his medications for the first time in years. And lo and behold, he no longer needed the hospital visits. One moment erased months of Stan's hard work. Stan learned that his rent was increasing by 15%, and having to choose between housing and his health, Stan did what I've seen so many of my patients do. He chose housing. So he took half of his medications, doubled his workload, and in that process ended right back up in the hospital. Because of his hospitalization, Stan couldn't work, which meant that he couldn't afford the rent increase, which meant he was forced to leave his home. And my last visit with Stan, he showed me a photo that was of that gorgeous walnut wood dining table, still unfinished, tumbled over into a dumpster. I have lost contact with Stan, and on good days, I like to imagine that somehow he found a way to move in with his estranged daughter in Northern California. But on most days, days like this one, I know he is more likely to be houseless on the streets, his chronic conditions deteriorating. So they tell us during residency that patients are our best teachers, and Stan was an exceptional teacher. But I have failed Stan's test, and I refuse to fail again. During complex decisions in my work, much like the one before you today, to make the relocation assistance ordinance permanent for all renters, I've learned to follow my true north, the needs of our community, our collective belief that we act for the common good, and Stan is pointing the way for us today, that true north, and I ask that we all follow him here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, all three of you.
Next three are Lois Molina, Hung Nam, and Ali Sayer, and they'll be followed by Erna Walt, Mariah Allen Claire, I believe his last name, and Corey Brooks. So right now we have Lois Molina, Hung Nam, and Ali Sayer.
Good afternoon. Would you like to start for us, please?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Lois Molina. I'm a landlord. I believe I'm a fair landlord, but I agree that tenants should not have to rely on the benevolence of landlords for security and fairness. The proposed amendments to the emergency ordinance providing relocation expenses to displaced tenants is indeed not perfect, but I think it's an improvement to the original language, and I support the amendments and the efforts to equalize landlord-tenant power. In particular, I support the amendment that exempts a property owner who sincerely intends to use their property to house a family member and perhaps invested in that property with that intention originally. You've crafted here an effective stick in this policy, and I'd like to suggest what might be an effective carrot. If housing stability and rent stabilization is the goal, I suggest that landlords who offer long-term leases or lease renewals, combined with a rent increase of no more than 2.5% per year, be exempt from relocation expenses if the landlord decides not to renew the lease. I believe this might also address what you alluded to earlier, Mr. Mayor, the gap between for-cause evictions and no-cause evictions. It again, is not a perfect solution, but I think that if you exempt those landlords who offer long-term leases while holding down rents, I believe that those landlords with a track record of doing that, with a track record of providing long-term security and holding down rents, can also be trusted to only deny a lease renewal if there is really just cause, while you work for a broader state policy on that.
Thank you. That's an interesting idea. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Hi. My name is Hyung Nam. I'm a Portland Public Schools teacher and also live in an owner-occupied duplex where I rent a unit, and I've done that for 16 years. And I want to give you some perspective from my experience as a landlord, and I want to argue for a very strong relo ordinance with very few exceptions, including do not have an exception for people like me. Who live in rent out a unit in an owner-occupied duplex. And, you know, I think this whole perspective where we're trying to, like, worry about all these things for landlords really and talk about mom-and-pop landlords leaves out how much we already subsidize landlords like me. We want to be fair to everyone in the city, not just to people who own property. And right now, people who own property, including landlords, get subsidies for their mortgages, mortgage interest. They write off all the costs that they incur. They have depreciation against their income up to, I believe, $25,000 a year. And this is while many people now are tenants, and only one-third of tax filers even do itemized deductions. Meanwhile, every single year, people that own property are gaining wealth because their tenants are paying their mortgage. Property values are increasing in Portland, have been increasing in the last couple years by more than double digits. That means that for median a property of $400,000, people even now with, I think, 7% increase, they're basically gaining about $30,000 a year in wealth just from their tenants paying their rent. So while we subsidize and allow landlords to spread the costs and tax expenditures and not pay taxes on so many of their costs, we basically subsidize landlords and while they share nothing in the equity that they gain and the wealth that they gain. And that's not fair. You know, we call this passive income. We shouldn't rely on people living off of other people's hard-earned income.
You've made a great point. Thank you. And again, folks, just reminding you, please stick to 2 minutes. Yes. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today about the relocation ordinance. My name is Allie Sayre. I'm a renter who lives in Southeast Portland. I initially moved to Portland from Beaverton because I was working as an emergency medical technician for the local ambulance company and needed to be close to work. As a low-wage worker, I was quickly priced out of my first place, so I moved in with a coworker. I lived there for 2 years and then was no cause evicted because he was selling his house. He sold the house for 400% of what he purchased it for. And this was before the relocation ordinance, but it was also an owner-occupied property, so I bore the entire cost of moving. I then moved into the top floor of an owner-occupied duplex. I had been living there for a year and a half when I was given a 90-day notice of an 18.75% rent increase because the house was owner-occupied and duplex, and my landlord's only property. They were exempt from having to pay relocation, and I again had to cover the thousands of dollars in moving costs. They recently posted the rental again for 50% more than what I paid. I do not understand why I am excluded from the relocation ordinance because my landlord did not own other properties. When you rent from a mom-and-pop landlord, you give up a lot of other things for lower rent. There's no handyman. There's no clubhouse. There's no off-street parking. There's far less privacy when your landlord is a staircase away. The normal social contract would extend both ways. That is, the landlord would recognize that they are not providing the same level of service as a large company and would charge accordingly. Despite the fact that their home is currently worth a staggering 620% more than what they purchased it for, their rent increase letter made a reference to market rent. What is the justification for market rent when you have a 620% return on investment by doing nothing except being lucky that you are able to buy at the right time? Landlord lobbyists want you to believe that landlords are barely covering their expenses. With all due respect, if being a landlord wasn't lucrative, they wouldn't have the money to afford lobbyists.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Do what's right and extend relocation coverage to all renters in Portland and make relocation permanent. Thank you.
Thank you. Next three, please. Thank you all.
Are Erna Walt, Mariah Allen Clare, I believe his last name, and Corey Bartos.
Good afternoon.
And they'll be followed by Daisy Quiones, Hilda Hernandez, and she's coming with an interpreter.
Good afternoon. My name is Erna Walter, and I'm a tenant in a 23-unit apartment building in Northeast Portland. I have been there 10 years, as have most of the tenants there, 10 to 15 years. The building was sold September of 2016 to Bristol Equities. And then last year, in September of 2017, we were sent a letter. In that year, we were just raised $65 for utilities. So the letter gave us three options. Option one, and we were paying, we were lucky enough to have a landlord that never raised our rent. We were paying $800 to $850 a month. So option one, residents may reserve their apartment to move back into after it has been renovated, pay a $500 execution deposit to reserve the apartment, along with signing an agreement which would require a new application. None of the tenants would have qualified for a new application because the rent was 100% increased to $1,650. The second option was to reserve another apartment that had been renovated, again a $500 execution fee, and signing another agreement with a new lease with updated terms. And option number three was offering the option of staying in our apartment, and the increase would be to $1,350. That would be about a $50% increase. There was no mention of RELO in this letter. And not only that, but we received the letter October 1st, and we needed to have an answer to them by 5 p.m. on October 20th, 19 days. It went too fast. I wanted to thank Legal Aid, Community Alliance of Tenants, and Commissioner Udalli's office for all of their support, and Portland Tenants United.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor, and members of the City Council. I'm Maria Lynn Clare, a county resident here in Portland, and a member of the Community Alliance of Tenants and Tenants Priced Out. I've been a resident here for a lot of years, and within the last 3 years, you know, I've noticed all of the tenants that I know and people that have talked to me are had their lives turned upside down because of the high price rents. And I really appreciate you all coming up with ways to kind of offset this. It reminds me of the 1995 when we had a flood here and we put sandbags downtown to keep the waters back. And so, you know, I know this is very, very complicated, and but I think it's important in the discussion that we've had on both sides with both the renters and the landlords. I told one landlord before I came in here that some of the people that have abused the system, and I tell you, as renters, we feel abused because on the one hand, the price and then the law is such that they can keep doing that to us. And on the other hand, there's no, even when we get a relocation ordinance, then what happens is, where do we go? And there are a lot of seniors that are getting priced out of these low-cost Section 42 buildings and the such. And so, you know, I hope you will further address that. One senior, for example, she's now sleeping on her mother's couch, who's 87 years old, because she can't afford even low-income housing. So I think that there's a lot that we need to do here, but I really appreciate everything that you've done so far. And in my case, I've been displaced 4 times, and 2 of which were rent increases. So I really understand having to keep moving over and over again. So I thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. We appreciate it. Good afternoon.
Hi. My name is Corey Bartos. I'm a member of the Community Alliance of Tenants, though I'm speaking on my own behalf today. To this esteemed body, I have been a resident of Portland for several years. I have physical and neurological disabilities, which make it difficult to engage in the actual act of moving, with my partner/caretaker having to take on most of the burden herself. This has resulted in lost wages, the intense stress of having to find a new residence with considerable haste, and scrambling our finances for the Herculean sum associated with the combined expenses of moving, including applying, background checks, the initial move-in costs, truck rental, etc. If you're lucky, you get your full deposit back, but it's not a guarantee. In addition, it's a challenge to find a place which is compatible with me regarding my disabilities. I'm currently on SSI, and my partner is currently working per diem through a professional temp agency. Money is tight, but we're getting by. Excuse me. An eviction notice would force us to leave Portland. It would be catastrophic. We might even possibly have to leave Oregon. We've established ourselves in the city and neighborhood with the neighbors and local neighborhood association, business owners, the mail carrier, and volunteer groups. Even the neighborhood cat comes running when I happen to be down the street to greet me. We vote, we donate to local schools, and we support others as they have supported us. Relocation assistance is necessary because without it, we would be ripped completely from the life we've built and the relationships that we've fostered, and there would be a great drain on our dignity and self-esteem, something not too often recognized. Relocation wouldn't cover all costs, but it would cover a lot. Please, please. Keep us in Oregon. Keep us